God and power, religion and politics. That's, I think, the core of the book of Shmuel. What is our relationship with God not supposed to look like? And what is our relationship with God supposed to look like? The last chapter of Sefer Shmuel is about a plague, and the plague spreads very, very quickly. And it seems like it's about to destroy the entire people of Israel. And at that moment, when David understands this, the plague is going to mean destruction to everything and to Jerusalem itself, according to Chronicles. So God instructs David what to do in order to stop the plague. Here's what he needs to do. He needs to go buy a field from a Jebusite called Arvana HaYevusi, or Ornan HaYevusi. He has to buy his, how do you say Gorin? He buys his field, and he builds an altar, and he offers the sacrifice on the altar, and when he does that, the plague stops, and the people are saved. And that is how the book ends. The book that opened with the ark in Shiloh, it ends with the altar in the field of Arvana, the Jebusite. Or it's called Ornan in Chronicles, the Jebusite. Where did this take? Where is this field? Where, it doesn't say what the location is. Where did this happen? Where is the field of Arvana, the Jebusite? So it doesn't say in the book of Shmuel, but it does say in the book of Chronicles. The book of Chronicles repeats many of the biblical stories, but it also gives us information that was lacking in many of the biblical stories. So it says in the book of Chronicles, when Shlomo builds Beit HaMikdash, so this is how he describes the location of Beit HaMikdash. This is how he describes the location of the temple. And I'm reading now from Chronicles 2, Chapter 3, verse 1. Vayachel Shlomo livnot et Beit Adonai b'Yerushalayim. And Shlomo began to build a house for God in Jerusalem. Behar HaMoriah, in Mount Moriah, asher nir'ah leDavid aviu, asher echin b'mekom David begoren Ornan HaYevusi. This is where God appeared to David in the Gorin, in the fields of Orvana or Ornan HaYevusi. So now we know where this took place. Where was the event that the altar and the sacrifice that started the plague took place? It was in Har HaMoriah, the same Har HaMoriah, where the temple will be built by the son of David, Shlomo, in Kings 1. So the book of Shmuel that begins in Shiloh, ends in Yerushalayim, ends in Har HaMoriah, and those are the book ends of Shiloh. Now, so what is the meaning of this story? That in the mountain, the same place where Shlomo is going to build the temple, that's when the tremendous story happened, where there was a plague and a sacrifice that David offered in the altar in Har HaMoriah stopped the plague. This kind of story is what scholars call an etiological story. It's a foundational story. It's a story that gives meaning to the temple. Meaning, if you would ask the priests or the Levites in the temple, what makes this place so special? They might answer, they have this story in mind. This is where David stopped the plague. You might ask them, how did he stop the plague? He said, by offering sacrifice. Which means every time we are offering sacrifice, maybe it's some kind of an echo, repetition of David's sacrifice. Maybe just like he saved Israel, maybe this is saving Israel. That's a story of Har HaMoriah that gives meaning that to everything that happens in Har HaMoriah. So it's an etiological story, a story that gives meaning to a place and its activities. But as we know, as I'm sure you all know, the story of David in Gorin Arvana Yevusi that happens in Har HaMoriah, the sacrifice that stopped the plague, that's not the only story that happened in Har HaMoriah. there is another story that happened in Har Moriah, and that is the Akedah, Akedat Yitzchak, that moment when Abraham was about to sacrifice his son. In the last moment, God appeared, an angel appeared, and told him, don't sacrifice your son, sacrifice the lamb instead. And that's also an etiological story. That's also in the background of all the activities in the temple. You would ask a priest or a Levi, what's unique about this place? They might tell you that story, the alternative story, Abraham's story. This is where the Akedah happened. This is where Abraham was willing to sacrifice everything for God. And the last minute, God stopped him and he sacrificed a lamb instead. What I'm saying is that our temple has not one, but two theological stories. Our temple in Yerushalayim has two foundational stories. And I want to compare these stories because they seem very similar. And they seem like they have a shared structure. But actually, deep down, they have hidden within them a very different theology. Now, these are important stories because these are the stories that uncovered the sacredness of Har Moriah, and they give meaning to the activity on Har Moriah. And if it's true that the temple is the heart of Jewish religion in biblical times, so if the temple resembles this religion, the worship of God, called Judaism, and there's two stories that somehow have within them, planted within them, the meaning of the temple. So in some way, these two stories have coded into them the DNA of Judaism itself. What we'll do now, in the next half an hour or so, is try to compare, understand these stories and compare these stories. Let's start with the Akedah. The Akedah is a story I'm sure you're acquainted with. It's a story that takes place in Sefer Bereshit, in the book of Genesis, chapter 22. So if you have a Tanakh, please open it up. In Bereshit, Kaf Bet, chapter 22. Vayhi achar hadvarim ha'ele, it says, chapter 22, verse 1, ve'elohim nisa'et Avraham, and God was testing Abraham. Vayomer elav Avraham, vayomer hineni, God says to Abraham, and he says, hineni, I'm here, I'm with you. Kach mat bincha, et yechidcha, asher ahavta Yitzchak. Take the son that you love, your only son that you really love, Yitzchak. And then it says, ve'lech lecha el eretz ha-moriah. Velech lecha, and go on, move ahead, start walking towards Eretz HaMoriah, where the Akedah will take place. Now, almost all the readers immediately will pick up on this. Lech lecha. This is not the first, but the second time Avraham hears those two words. Lech lecha. Walk ahead. Move on. When was the first time? And by the way, it's also the only times, not only in Abraham's biography that he hears Lech Lecha, it's also the only times in the Tanakh where someone hears God say to them, Lech Lecha. It happened to Avraham twice. The first Lech Lecha was the first time we met Avraham in Parashat, Lech Lecha. And there God told him, Lech Lecha me'artzecha, mimoladetcha, mibet avicha. Leave your country, leave your homeland, leave everything behind, and start walking. And he finds himself in Eretz Yisrael. That was the first time God tested him. Are you willing to leave everything you have behind? Now is the last time God tests him. And again, with Lech Lecha. Are you willing to sacrifice your son for me? Now, what I'm going to share now is an insight by two people, by three people. It's a combination now. Yeshayahu Leibovich, Martin Buber, and the great biblical scholar Uriel Simon. I'm offering now a combination of all their thoughts. We have the first Lech Lecha and we have the second Lech Lecha. The first Lech Lecha, what was it about? It was about sacrifice. Abraham was asked by God to sacrifice his past, to give up on everything he had, to give up, to turn his back to his past. Actually, not only to sacrifice his past, he was also asked to sacrifice his present.
But that double sacrifice of your past and your presence had meaning. Why? Because he comes to Eretz Yisrael and he said, from your seeds,
your zera, will bring a blessing to the world.
That from your seeds, from your descendants, there'll be a blessing to the world.
So actually, those sacrifices, of the first Lech Lecha, willing to sacrifice his past, sacrifice his present, that's all for the future. So you're being blessing to the world through his seeds. But there's only one problem. Abraham doesn't have any kids, doesn't have any children.
So he has to believe in God that these blessings will become a reality. That one day I will have a child, and that child in the end will turn into a family and a tribe and a nation. They'll bring blessing to the world. But he sacrifices past for the future, but he doesn't see the future because he doesn't have any kids.
So the story of Genesis, you know, I'm not going to go over it, but it's like every time he thinks maybe this is it. First, I think he thought it was his adopted son, Lot. And then it wasn't Lot. He had to separate himself from Lot. Then he thought it was a servant, Eliezer. And then God says to him, Lo yirashcha ze. It's not Eliezer. Ki ma yotze mi me'echa hu yirashcha.
Someone if someone carrying your real biological genes is going to inherit your, not your servant, not Damesek Eliezer. And then Ishmael is born. And Abraham is sure this is it. It's Ishmael. But then his wife tells him to throw away, to get rid of Ishmael. And God tells him to do what your wife says. Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah, shma bikol. Like, shma bikola. So where is the son? Where is the, I sacrificed my past for the future. Where is the future? Yitzchak is born. This is the future. This is it. He's the one. And then the Akedah comes. And then the second Lech Lecha kicks in. And he tells them, now you have to go and sacrifice Yitzchak.
So what's really happening here? His entire life, he had to sacrifice his past for the future. And then one day, God says to him, now sacrifice the future. Everything he did in life was channeled towards Yitzchak. And now God tells him, now sacrifice Yitzchak. In other words, the Akedah should be understood the following way. When Abraham was about to sacrifice Yitzchak, he wasn't only going to sacrifice Yitzchak, he was going to sacrifice Avraham. Meaning, if Yitzchak dies, all the sacrifice he did throughout his entire life, everything he gave everything up for the future, now he sacrifices the future. Meaning, at the moment he sacrifices Yitzchak, he's emptying his entire life's project from meaning. All the first Lech Lecha is now emptied from meaning because of the second Lech Lecha. Meaning not only Yitzchak was there in Har Moriah about to be sacrificed, Yitzchak was going to lose his life, Avraham was going to lose the meaning and the purpose of his life.
This, by the way, since the Akedah is such a dominant story in Judaism, since it's a foundational story of the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, and Beit HaMikdash resembles Judaism itself in biblical times, if this is a story that gives meaning to the Mikdash, and the Mikdash resembles Judaism, so Leibovitz, Yishai Leibovitz says, this is what Judaism is about. Judaism is about sacrifice. Judaism is about suffering for something bigger than yourself. Giving up something within yourself for something bigger than yourself. That's Judaism. And Leibovitz makes the following distinction. Here's what Judaism is not. Judaism is not about what Judaism does for me. Maybe you might think that Judaism is this religion that heals relationships within the family. When you practice Judaism, there is more intimacy and connection within a family. Maybe you think Judaism brings to your life the gifts of community. Maybe you feel Judaism brings to your life gifts of spirituality and song and connection. Maybe if that's the reason why you're participating in Judaism, that's an ego-centered Judaism, says Leibovitz. Judaism is in service of you. The Akedah has a different understanding. Judaism is not about what Judaism does for you. It's actually about what you do for God. The question is not what does Judaism give to you, it's what Judaism takes from you. It's not what it offers you, it's what it demands from you. Judaism is about sacrifice. That's how Yeshayahu Leibovich learns, that's what he learns from the Akedah as the foundational story of Judaism. Leibovich even compares the Akedah to the crucifixion. The crucifixion, in Leibovich's understanding, is a story from Christian theology, is a story about God sacrificing his son for the benefit of man, of humanity. God sacrifices his son for humanity. That's the crucifixion. The Akedah is the opposite. It's not God sacrificing his son for humanity. It's a human being sacrificing his son for God. It's not God in service of us. It's us in service of God. That is the Akedah. It breaks the sense of Judaism as an ego-centered religion. It's not about me, it's I'm about God. That's how Leibovich understands the Akedah. That's how Martin Buber reads the Akedah. The second Lech Lecha combined with the first Lech Lecha empties your life from meaning. You sacrifice the past for the future, now sacrifice the future, and as a result, emptying all the other sacrifices from purpose and from meaning. That's Judaism. But there's a caveat here. Avraham, in the end, did not sacrifice Yitzchak. At the last moment, God appears. I hope we'll manage to pull this off time-wise. Not God, a malach, an angel representing God, appears and says, Al tishlach et chananar. V'al ta'as lo me'uma. Don't sacrifice your son. Sacrifice the lamb instead. Meaning, in other words, God is interested in motivation, not in action. He's interested in the motivation for sacrifice, not in actual sacrifice. The separation between motivation and action. He says to him, Ata yadati ki yare Elohim ata. I see that you have the motivation, you're willing to sacrifice your son. That's enough. Please don't sacrifice your son. The Akedah in the end of the day isn't about what happened, it's about what didn't happen. It's the story that didn't happen. It's the sacrifice that didn't happen. It's about the motivation for self-sacrifice without the action of self-sacrifice. So now I want to move from the Akedat Yitzchak that happens in Har HaMoriah to what I want to call Akedat David that also happens in Har HaMoriah, offering an alternative story. An alternative ethiological story, an alternative foundational story of Har HaMoriah and the Mikdash in Yerushalayim, and maybe Judaism itself. And by the way, a method I'm going to use, the story appears twice, once in Shavuot, second time in Chronicles. Now, the people who wrote Chronicles had a tendency to say the stories again and sometimes censor parts of the stories. The book of Chronicles censors almost all the sins of David. He didn't sin. You know how there's a Talmudic tradition that says that David never sinned? Well, it's actually a biblical tradition. It's the tradition of Chronicles. By the way, I personally believe that it's out of respect for David that we speak about his sins. We don't deny his faults. We don't hide his weaknesses. It's to respect David. I'll tell you why. When you say that David didn't really sin, you're not listening to David. David told the prophet Natan, Chatati Lehashem, I have sinned to God. So if you say David didn't sin, you're not listening to David. You're not respecting David. My reading, trying to point out miscalculations of Shmuel, sins of David, is out of deep respect to the way these figures are portrayed, and respect, I'm listening to the words of David himself, Chatati Lehashem. But after saying that, there is a tradition saying that David never sinned. But it's not only a Talmudic tradition, it's a biblical tradition. It begins in Chronicles. In Chronicles, when they repeat the stories of David, they erase all his sins. I'll give you an example. There's a battle against the Philistines in Emek Rephaim. We have Emek Rephaim today in Jerusalem. And the Philistines, they flee. They run away. They escape because they lost the battle. And they forgot their gods behind.
So in Sefer Shmuel, it says that David just picked up the gods and took them for himself. It says that. The book of Chronicles didn't like that. So it says, he took the gods and burnt them. That doesn't say that way in the book of Shmuel. It does say in the patched up version of Divrei Hayamim. In Divrei Hayamim, David did not sleep with Bathsheba. He did not kill Uriah. All those stories are not in Divrei Hayamim, or not in Chronicles. Why am I saying this? Because if Chronicles have a tendency to censor the book of Shmuel, every time we see an intervention, when we see that the book of Chronicles changed something subtle in the story, that might mean that there's something radical, something critical in that story. So I'm going to use now the book of Chronicles as a method to read Shmuel. Wherever we'll see, well, it will happen once, but in dramatic points, the book of Chronicles is censoring the story of David. I want to ask, why did it censor it? And maybe that means there's something critical here about David that we might have missed in a regular reading. Meaning I'm reversing it. If Chronicles is censoring in order to hide the sin, I want to use a censorship in order to detect the sin. If you're following, is that clear? If you're following what I'm trying to do from a literary point of view. Great. So we're going to read Shmuel and sometimes peek and see how this story was described in Chronicles in Divrei Hayamim. There's a lot of weird things in this story. I can't explain everything, like the first verse. Chapter 24. Vayosef af Adonai lacharot b'Yisrael, vayaset et David b'him. It says here that God seduced David to sin. How do you say vayaset? Enticed? Is enticed a word? He enticed David to sin. Theologically, it's very, very bizarre that God is enticing David to sin. I can't explain this. And I've never read a good interpretations I've read were not persuasive enough. Just want to notice, when this story appears in Chronicles, it says that the person who enticed David to sin is not God, it's the devil. So here you see how censorship is trying to make, to protect God, you know, from the eyes of the reader, from the judgment of the readers. Lech menet Israel. Now David is somehow motivated by God, by the devil, by an internal voice to go count the people of Israel. Lech menet Israel ve'et Yehuda. Vayomer ha-melech el Yoav, so the king says to Yoav, Sarachai la-sharito, to his general, Shot na bechol shivtei Yisrael, midan v'ad b'er sheva, ufikdu et ha'am v'yadat et misparam. Go all over Israel. Count the people. Why do I want to count the people? The answer is, it's cyclical. So I will know the number of the people. Count the number in order that I will know the number. Now, biblically, this is a sin. It says in the Torah, you're not allowed to count. You are allowed to count. This is what common interpretation, because there's one census and then another census. Two, how do you say census in plural? Censuses? Yes?
Census.
Okay. Census, okay. Okay, so we have two censuses in the Bamidbar. So I guess you're allowed to have a census, but it's also a sin to have a census. So how do you explain it? If the census has a purpose, you're allowed to do it. Let's say you're counting the soldiers because you're going to attack the enemy. You need to know the number. So you could divide the forces. We'll have 2/3 here, 1/3 there, and attack effectively the enemy. Or you want to build something, you need to know how many people. Okay, if it has a purpose, it's permitted. But if it doesn't have a purpose, it's a sin to count. Why is it a sin to count with no purpose? Because if it has a purpose, your counting is in service of the people. But if it doesn't have a service, if it doesn't have a purpose, it's in service of your own ego. This is how Nachmanides explains the sin of counting. He says, why does a king count with no purpose? He says, Lesamech libo shel melech lefi shemalach al amrav. Okay? Lesamech libo, like to make his heart happy, that he sees that he's the king, that he's the sovereign of many people. It's an ego thing. Wealthy people like to count their money. Why? They like to be exposed to their wealth. Powerful people like to count their power. Why? They want to be exposed to their power.
And Nachmanides picks up on this psychology. When a powerful people is exposed to his power, he gets high on it. Look how powerful I am. So you see, when you count the people, so you are thinking in an instrumental way about your people. They are there in service of your ego. They are there for you to feel powerful. They are there for your self-glorification. That's why we're not allowed to count. We all count, right? How many people are in the Zoom session now? How many people bought my book? How many people? We all want. That's a seduction the Bible asks us to overcome. Powerful people shouldn't be exposed to their power. And if you count, it's in service of the people. If it's with no purpose, the people are in service of your psychological needs. They're in service of you. So that's my understanding of the sin that David is now performing this sin. Yoav tries to stop him. David urges him, go do it. Yoav goes to count the people. He has a delegation. They go through all of Israel. By the way, they go from east, they cross the Jordan River. They go from east to north, from north to west, from west to the shore. They cover Israel. They count the people to Israel. And they hand over to David the number. And now David is a powerful person, exposed to his power. He has the number. And how does he respond to that? After he gives him the number, this is what it says in verse 10. Vayach lev David oto, achareichen safar et ha'am. Vayach lev David oto. It literally says, his heart hit him, struck him, after he counted the people, after he performed the census. What does it mean that his heart hit him, struck him? I find there could have three meanings here. One, the literal meaning, he has a heart attack. His heart is attacking him. He has a heart attack. Second, more probable, it's a guilt attack. Vayach lev David oto. He feels guilty, very guilty, for performing this sin. A third, most probable, he has a panic attack. He's terrified. He knows he sinned. He knows a punishment is coming, and he is terrified. So it's either biological, either it's a heart attack or a guilt attack or a panic attack. It's probably a combination of a panic attack and a guilt attack. It doesn't really matter. What is important that David feels pain. He feels horrible. He feels terrible. And this pain that he's experiencing as a result of him counting is leading him to ask something from God. This is what he's asking from God. Vayomer David el Adonai, chatati meod asher asiti. I have terribly sinned. Ve'ata, now, Adonai, ha'averna avon avdecha, ki niskalti meod. He's saying, ha'averna avon avdecha. Take my sin and ha'aver. What does ha'aver mean? Ha'averna. So, he doesn't use the term kapara, he uses the term ha'avara. This is actually a very important distinction. Kapara, as Milgram explains, sees the sin as dirt, and kapara is to clean it. So please, erase the sin. Ha'avara sees the sin as weight. Gadol avonim minso, it's weight, I'm carrying on me. And ha'avara is not erasing the sin, ha'avara is relocating the sin somewhere else. Imagine it's something like it's a baggage, it's weight, and you're relocating it. Ha'avara. You are moving it somewhere else. So David is asking God not for kapara, but for ha'avara. Not to erase the sin, but to relocate the pain he's experiencing, to relocate it, to put it somewhere else. He's saying, I can't carry this. I can't. Please put it somewhere else. Relocate it. That's the literal meaning of his prayer. So God responds. He sends a prophet to him with an answer. The prophet is called God, not G-O-T, not God. Okay? God, Gimel Dalet, okay? G-A-D, okay? God, that's his name. Like Shevet God. And V'dvar Adonai Yael God HaNavi, Chose David Lemo, and then I'll make it, we're running out of time, so I'll make it shorter. God comes to David and he says to him, well, God listened to your prayer and he's willing to relocate your sin. Okay? You have three options, three different scenarios, three ways to deal with this, three possible punishments. Punishment number one, he says, Sheva shanim ra'av ba'artzecha. One way, one possible punishment is 7 years of famine in your country. Second is, Shlosha cholashim uscha lifnei tzarecha. A battle with your enemy that will last 3 months and you will be defeated by your enemy. Third option, a plague that lasts 3 days, a pandemic of 3 days. Now just tell me, here's the recipe, three possible punishments. You get to choose whatever you want. It's very weird, but this is what David asked for. He said, I can't carry this. Locate it somewhere else. He comes back, well, here's how it could be located. Your sin could appear in the form of a punishment of famine, military defeat, or pandemic, or epidemic, or a plague. Right? Pandemic is worldly. Epidemic, right? Magifa, it's local. Epidemic. So, okay, now David chooses, from this recipe, he chooses the plague. Now here's what I want to argue. Sin number one was counting the people. Then God says, choose your punishment. After he asked, move it somewhere else, chooses the punishment. And what should have David noticed? Immediately. That God is taking the sin off the back of David, but who is going to be punished for it? Am Yisrael. For his individual sin, the collective is going to suffer. Either because of famine, or military defeat, or the plague. You see, we thought that the sin was counting that led to the punishment. I think the biggest sin is the fact that he chooses one of the punishments. He's relocating the sin. Now the sin, he's not going to suffer from the sin. Let the people suffer for me and instead of me. This is the real sin. Now it's hard. Now, by the way, this sin is in line with the first sin. Because the first sin of counting, he has an instrumental relationship with the people. They are there for me. But counting, they are there for my ego needs, to glorify me, in service of my psychological needs. Now the next sin, then the people are not there to glorify me, they are there to suffer for me and instead of me. Instead of being a leader in service of the people are in service of the leader. In the first sin, they are there to satisfy his self-esteem. Look how powerful I am. In the second one, they are there not to glorify him, but to suffer for him and instead of him. I shouldn't say this, but I am going to say this because there's a thought in my mind. According to Christian theology, classic Christian theology, Jesus Christ is suffering instead of everyone else, because he's suffering for everyone else. David is like here the opposite. instead of him suffering for everyone else, he's like let's have everyone else suffer for me and instead of me. Now, if you think that this is a radical reading of me, I think this is a reading of Chronicles. This is how Divrei Hayamim understands. I want to show this. Because when David chooses his punishment, this is what he says. Vayomer David el Gad, tsar li me'od, niplana biyad Adonai ki rabim rachamav, uvebiyad adam alepola. He's saying, I choose plague because I'm so pious, because I want to be in the hands of God. I want God to punish me. And a plague is considered in biblical times like a direct strike of God. And like being defeated by the enemy is having other people punish me. I just want God to punish me directly. If I was cynical, I would say military defeat, that would look bad for the general, for David. Plague seems like it's force majeure. No one could blame you in biblical times for a plague. Famine, by the way, if there's an economic crisis, you blame the leader. If there's a military crisis, you blame the leader. If it's a plague, it's like, okay, it's bigger than us. So that's me being cynical about David. But for good reasons, I'm cynical. Because this is because when he says, in a pious way, Niplana b'yad Adonai, let us, in plural, fall in the hands of God, this is the problem. He sinned, but as a collective, he wants us to suffer. The author of the Vilayamim picked up on this. And the author of the Vilayamim changed the Nun to Aleph. Instead of Niplana bide Adonai, David says, Eplana, let me suffer. This is censorship. Turning the Nun into an Aleph, a plural to the singular, David is saying, let me suffer. And if Divrei HaYamim intervened, which means Divrei HaYamim feels there's something problematic, and this is what's problematic, that he wants to, because he's speaking in plural, let us suffer, not me suffer. Let the collective pay the price for my individual sin. So there is a plague, and the plague spreads. And David sees the plague spreading, and he's terrified. And then in verse 17, this is David changes. And it's the most important moment in this chapter, maybe the most important moment in the book. Vayomer David el Adonai, birotor et ha-malach ha-makeh ba'am. He sees the plague as a malach, like there is a personification of the plague, like sees it in the vision of a person killing the people. And he sees Hamakeh Ba'am, Vayomer, and then David says, Hine Anochi Chatati, Ve Anochi He'eveti, Ve Ele Atzon Me'asu. David is saying to God, I have sinned individually. Why are the people of Israel as a collective suffering? In Chronicles, it says even more powerfully, Halo anochi ani amarti limnot ba'am, va'ani hu asher chatati, va'arei ha'ra'oti ve'ele atzon ma'asu. So now David recognizes, it's my individual sin. It can't be a collective punishment. He regrets that he asked for a collective punishment instead of to pay for his individual sin. And now this is what he says to God. After he realizes that the collective is suffering for his individual sin, now he says the following. Tiyena yadcha bi ubebet avi. Stop destroying the people. Take me instead. Me and my family. Take me instead. And in Chronicles, Tiyena, Chronicles is even more clear. Tiyena yadcha bi ubebet avi veba'am lo lemageifa. Take me instead of the people. This is the grand moment of tshuva of David. How do you say tshuva? Repentance? The grand moment. This is the moment where if in stage one, the people in service of his ego, he counts them. In stage two, the people suffer for him. In stage three, he breaks this pattern and he says, I will suffer for the people. Take me, not the people. This is his tshuva. Understanding that a real king doesn't see the people, that he doesn't think the people are there to serve him, he's there to serve for the people. And if I need to die for the people, I'll die for the people. Take me. You see, the basic fundamental difference between David and Abraham is that they both in Har HaMoriah expressed the will for the ultimate self-sacrifice. The difference is that Abraham was linear. He was willing for two. He was just linear the whole time. He never changed. He was a tzaddik. He was pious. He was willing to sacrifice everything for God. That's Avraham. From the first Lech Lecha till the last Lech Lecha. David is not linear. David is complicated. David is chaotic. David is dynamic. David changes. David does tshuva. David, as Chazal says, is the inventor of the idea of tshuva. Mekim ula shel tshuva. And just like he said in the story of Bathsheba, Chatati Lashem, now he says Chatati, but my sin is that I saw the people in service of me while I am in the service of people. Now we'll reverse it. The people won't suffer for me, and instead of me, I will suffer for them and instead of them. So we have here the Akedah all over again. But the Akedah in all the meaning of the Akedah. Because after David says, just take me, not them. You know what God says to him? Go to Gor Arvana Yevusi. Go to buy that field. Build an altar. Slaughter an animal. He does that. And the Mageifa stops. And the plague stops. Which means God wanted to see the motivation for self-sacrifice, but not the action of self-sacrifice. For all these reasons, we have the Akedah number two here. In Har HaMoriah, two people expressed the will of self-sacrifice. In both stories, it's about the self-sacrifice that didn't happen. Avraham didn't kill Yitzchak. David didn't die instead of the people. In both cases, sacrificing an animal replaced self-sacrifice. So we can understand why these are two foundational stories of the Mikdash. Maybe trying to create a narrative. Every time you sacrifice an animal, you might think, this is Ibn Ezra, by the way, it could have been me, the animals instead of me. Religion is about self-sacrifice, and this is a substitute. And after noticing that it's like the same story twice, just with the difference of character, Avraham is linear, David is dynamic, Avraham is a tzaddik, David is a baal tshuva. After noticing how these are the same stories happening in the same place of self-motivation, and God wants self-sacrifice, and God wants motivation, not action, after saying all that, it seems like we have a conclusion. And the conclusion is that religion is about sacrifice. It's about sacrifice something for yourself in service of something bigger than yourself. And after saying that, and after feeling that these are the same stories, I want to notice that they are opposite stories. Theologically, there is a contradiction between these stories. Because yes, both are saying Judaism is about sacrificing something from yourself in service of something bigger than yourself. But what is that thing that is bigger than yourself? According to the Akedah, it's God. Abraham was willing to sacrifice Yitzchak because he was a God-fearing person. God commanded Abraham is obedient. Obey Abraham does it. Abraham sacrificed Yitzchak. He's willing to sacrifice himself for something bigger than himself, and that something that's bigger than himself is God. But why is David willing to sacrifice himself? When it comes to David, it's to stop the plague and save Am Yisrael. Akedat Avraham is sacrificing for the God of Israel. Akedat David is sacrificing for the people of Israel. What makes this so powerful is the two stories with the same structure but opposite theologies. What does it mean to be a good Jew? To live in service of something bigger than yourself, that's what these two stories share. But what is the thing that's bigger than yourself? Is it God of Israel or the people of Israel? Some good friends of mine that never believed in God, that lost their lives fighting Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hamas in Gaza, their story is not Akedat Yitzchak. It's Akedat David. For them, being a great Jew is giving up everything for Am Yisrael, not Elohei Yisrael, not the God of Israel. This is what Zionism brought to the Jewish world in the 20th century, when we had pious Jews surrendering everything, giving up everything, living very poor lives, studying Torah, performing mitzvot in the service of God. Zionism said, we need to live in service, but they were so involved being in service of God, they became passive and weak and surrendering to God, which made them even more passive and more weak. And Zionism comes up and says, we have to be strong. We have to put ourselves together. And secular Zionism said, only when we will forget about the gods of Israel, well, we have this, the God of Israel, we have, they have the strength to build something great for the people of Israel. And Zionism demands a new form of sacrifice, the ultimate sacrifice, self-sacrifice, not for God of Israel, but for Am Yisrael. The 20th century, you find two answers to the question, what does it mean to be a good Jew? Both answers are about self-sacrifice, but sacrifice for what? If you're ultra-Orthodox, it's about Torah and God. If you're a secular Zionist, it's for Am Yisrael, and for, in today's world, Medinat Yisrael. Who's right, by the way? Secular Zionists or ultra-Orthodox? Who's right? Let's ask the Tanakh. So we open the Tanakh and we ask who's right, and we find the Tanakh not one answer, but two answers. We find Akedat Yitzchak, the religious answer, and we find Akedat David, the national answer. The Tanakh canonized both answers, meaning both types of Jews will open the Tanakh and find themselves, some in Akedat Yitzchak, some in Akedat David. The book of Shmuel starts with Shiloh and ends in Yerushalayim. The religion of Shiloh was an ark-centered religion, but it was actually an ego-centered religion. Why? The ark was there to protect them, to save them from the Philistines. Later on, the theology of the ark will give them the illusion that the temple is protecting us. The temple is offering us immunity. The temple is about us. The ark is about us. Religion is in service of us. It's an ego-centered religion. That's the religion of Shiloh. The alternative is Yerushalayim. The alternative is Akedat Yitzchak. The alternative is Akedat David. The alternative is saying that that religion, that Judaism, is that the question you ask is not, that God is not in service of you, you're in service of God. Religion is not the opportunity to take the gifts of religion and empower my life, but to take parts of my life in service of something bigger than my life. What is bigger than your life? Is it the people or is it God? That's the open question. It's the open question because the Tanakh canonized both answers. The answer of the Akedah in Bereshit and the answer of David in Shmuel. But it starts with, and this is the journey we try to do together in five sessions. A journey that starts with Shiloh, ends in Jerusalem, starts with a ego-centered religion, the religion that's about yourself. Moving to Yerushalayim, the religion is about sacrificing yourself, forgetting yourself. It's about living for something bigger than yourself.